This is Block by Block, a community news program from WPPM LP 106.5 FM, where we explore issues affecting the Philadelphia area with news reports from members of the community. I'm Sophia Mattia.
And I'm Donya Ramadan. In the next half hour, we'll hear stories from our community news reporters about the impact of tariffs on Philly's skater scene, how a Haitian-American filmmaker is responding to challenges facing Black cultural workers, and a group of volunteers helping save the lives of toads in Northwest Philly.
But first, Philadelphia City Council could approve a set of bills this month that would put some limits on ICE activity. Among other things, they'd prohibit city workers from cooperating with ICE and ban law enforcement officers from wearing masks. Council members Kendra Brooks and Rue Landau introduced legislation earlier this year. And during a hearing on Monday, Councilmember Landau explained why the seven bills matter.
This legislation draws a clear line. Philadelphia will not be complicit in policies that undermine the safety and dignity of our neighbors. Philadelphia will not use our resources to destabilize communities. Philadelphia will not turn its back on the very people who make this city. This is not new territory for Philadelphia. We've been a welcoming city. We believe in protecting immigrant communities. Our values have long been rooted in inclusion, dignity, and respect. But being a welcoming city cannot just be branding. It cannot just be something we put on a website or say at a press conference. It has to mean something in people's real everyday lives. It has to show up. It has to show up in how every agency operates every single day.
15 of City Council's 17 members have signed on to co-sponsor the legislation, which means there's a veto-proof majority and the bills are expected to become law. The bills could come up for a final vote as soon as April 23rd. But many Philadelphians have been taking matters into their own hands by participating in direct actions and other acts of civil disobedience to confront ICE. My co-host, Donya Ramadan, attended a recent action and brings us this story.
ICE in Philly has got to go!
Standing in front of the Philadelphia ICE field office at a recent No ICE Philly action on the morning of April 3rd, I chat with No ICE Philly volunteer, Reverend Jay Bergen.
We have a group of about 15 folks from across the city of Philadelphia, everyday people who were moved to try to stop ICE from carrying out any kidnappings. And they're singing and chanting and blocking the garage doors, which is where ICE sends vehicles in and out when they go to kidnap our neighbors, to terrorize our communities. And they've been here at this point for basically an hour. So that's 1 hour less that ICE has to harm people in our communities.
Reverend Jay says the ICE office in Philly is the headquarters for immigration and customs enforcement across the state. So anything activists can do to slow down operations helps keep people safe throughout the region. And they say blocking their garage is just one thing people are doing.
ICE agents are scared of being recognized. They know that what they're doing is harmful to people, that it's violent, that it's oppressive, that it's undemocratic.
Reverend Jay says ICE agents have been trying to hide their identities to avoid confrontation, but community members are keeping track of the unmarked vehicles they use, which include rentals from a company called Enterprise.
Folks across Philly who've been documenting these vehicles so that we know what vehicles they're driving, what license plates they normally use. So even if they were to get a vehicle out after folks here were forced out of the way, we'd still be able to track where that vehicle's going.
And although the Philadelphia Police Department has an order that they aren't supposed to collaborate with ICE enforcement efforts, somehow they still stand in the way of protesters trying to prevent those kidnappings.
When Philadelphians try to prevent those kidnappings, like we're doing today, Philadelphia police are very happy to use physical force to drag people, push people, and try to force people out of the way so that ICE can carry out their terror campaign.
And as police geared up to make arrests, protesters doubled down to make it clear who they are doing this for.
This is for Victor, who died inside.
Folks here who are here blocking the garage doors are all wearing name tags. Those names are the names and the ages of people murdered by ICE in the past couple of months, whether that is folks that ICE have killed out on the street while they're performing a kidnapping, or people who have died later in ICE detention.
This is for Parity, who died inside.
So here in Philadelphia, Parity Law was a man who was taken by ICE and who died actually in our federal detention center just two blocks from here. He was a father. He was a family person. He was a member of his community, and he died because of medical neglect. As long as federal thugs are able to operate like this in our city and around the country, more people like Parity will continue to be killed.
This is for our neighbors who are locked inside.
While actions like blocking the ICE garage are largely a response to recent ICE abuses, for years, several groups in the Philly region have been advocating for members of the immigrant community who are locked inside. I spoke with Deputy Director of Free Migration Project, Adriana Torres Garcia, who connected the significance of advocacy like No ICE Phillies Today to their long-term organizing against detention centers like Berks and Moshannon in Greater Pennsylvania.
I think now people are becoming more aware, and I think they should be angry. Everyone should be angry. And so it's nice to see that actions like these are regular people waking up to the realities of where their taxpayer money is going and that they're doing something about it. There are many ways of fighting, not just calling your congressperson, which is important, but also directly affecting the pipeline of transportation or whatever it is facilitating for ICE to be doing their jobs in enforcement. Interrupting that sends a really important message, and I think it creates solidarity and it creates a sense of empowerment within people. For example, in the Shutdown Berks campaign, it was an 8-year campaign. We had vigils every month outside of the detention center. And there were also protests and there were also rallies and there were also days of like going to Harrisburg or having meetings with the governor's staff or Congress people or local electeds. And the same thing with Shutdown Moshannon. The tactics that we're using right now are part of a larger strategy to shut down the detention center for good.
Adriana says a number of our own immigrant community members are stuck inside these detention centers under heinous conditions, which have only gotten worse with increased funding.
We are in communication with people inside Moshannon. Every time we talk to different people on the inside, they are very consistent that there is abuse of power, that there's not enough access to health care or to, you know, nutritious food or to even like hygiene products or their bed sheets and their clothes being washed and things like that. So they're treated like animals, like they're not treated with dignity. And right now we're talking to someone inside who has been asking for help for his mental health for a long time. And he hasn't been provided proper mental health care. And now he's just like, you know, I'm at the end of my rope here. I've been in solitary for 2 months. You know, after a certain time of being in solitary, that is considered torture by the United Nations. And Moshannon uses solitary confinement more than any other detention center in our area, in our state.
And Adriana says while the conditions are different now with ICE's increased funding compared to when the community shut down Berks County Detention Center in 2023, it still remains clear that there is only one solution.
Action is really what's going to sustain us through these times. It can start with talking to your neighbor, joining an action. Get curious about who has the power to make these decisions in my community and why are they not consulting me, a member of the community.
For Philly Cam's Block by Block, I'm Dunya Ramadan.
Philadelphia is a city with a strong skateboarding community that's been making use of city streets, parks, and urban architecture for decades. But over the past year, tariffs have driven up the cost of skateboarding gear. And it's hit skate shops and skaters in the area hard. Block by Block reporter Milan Parker spoke with owners of two Philly skate shops to find out more about the impact of tariffs on the city's skate scene and how they're responding.
Philadelphia has long been a skateboarding mecca, with iconic locations for skaters including Love Park in Center City and FDR Skate Park in South Philly. And while Philly already had a thriving skater community, Zimbo Temple of Skate and Design owner Chad Dravick says a lot of people started skating during the COVID-19 pandemic.
COVID, everyone was skating, looking for something to do. And that was like 20-something professionals coming in, young kids, older women. Like, everyone was getting skateboards. So definitely all skate shops were doing incredibly well during COVID.
But Chad says while sales were up for a few years, that started to change in 2023.
And that's not just our shop. It's all skate shops across the nation. We all have the same problem. And sales have been going down and the cost of things have been going up. So it's a tough area.
A big part of the reason costs have gone up over the past year? Many of the parts used to make skateboards come from overseas, so they've been affected by the Trump administration's tariffs on imports. Ron Cornwall is the co-owner of Together Skateboarding, a skate shop and cafe in Brewery Town. He says skateboarding bearings maker Bones was one of the first to raise prices.
Like, immediately when tariffs got announced, Bones raised the price of bearings. Now, I know there's a warehouse somewhere with all these f***ing bearings. And now, bearings that everybody that I've known forever spent $14.95 on for 20 years, now they got to pay $24.95. That's a big increase. A family comes in and buys a skateboard for a six-year-old, they'll spend $100. But they're going to think twice about $125. And I don't know why that is or what the arithmetic of that is, but I watch it in their faces. You know, oh, maybe next year for $125. It's a big difference. They're affecting the business. Tariffs, you can see it start to affect the business. And now they're trickling into some other parts. When I go to buy complete boards from my distributors, they're a lot more expensive than last year. And there's a big financial toll to that.
The pressures of tariffs impacted Chad far beyond the price tags on merchandise. Zimbo recently relocated to Kensington, and with that move came a much smaller space.
That's also kind of why we were forward thinking. We're like, you know what? We really should move into a newer spot with better foot traffic, lower overhead. So that's why we moved to this new location.
But Chad says even if skateboard sales are down, there are other ways his business is serving the community. For example, he's introduced a service to digitize old videos recorded on VHS or Hi-8 tapes, helping preserve some of Philly's skateboard history. Some of those videos have held personal value.
I've digitized someone's senior video project that they haven't watched in years, and she shared it with all of her classmates, and she even followed up with a message saying, thank you so much for digitizing it. So many people have not seen that for like 20-some years.
And some videos have a broader impact. For example, Chad found a video of one of the first times a skater performed an iconic trick in Philly's Love Park, a spot that was designed for pedestrians, but which had a level of design that attracted skaters.
Since the mid-80s, skateboarders have been flocking to it from all over the world because it was like a mini skate park. One of the major things to do there is to ollie into the fountain from the top to the bottom. So I found, his name's Choppy Omega, the actual video footage of him ollieing into it. Because for years, it's always been who was the first to do it, and there was a couple names thrown around, but there was never actual video footage. And then in this box of Hi-8 tapes, I came across it. That was pretty incredible and monumental of a find.
While Zimbo preserves physical media, the tapes, the footage, the moments that might otherwise disappear, Together Skateboarding is preserving something just as tangible, a physical space in a real neighborhood where neighbors show up. And for Ron, no tariff can put a price on that.
Together Skateboarding is my family coming together to build a community space. And that the community's embraced it is the greatest thing that's happened in my life, besides my family, so that we can all share in it together. It's been amazing. And that the skateboarders that do hang out with us, skate with us, and accept us have been as rewarding as anything else I've ever done either. And they just love skateboarding, and that we can help skaters stay stoked and help skaters keep pushing, then I'm doing something good that's good going into the world. And then I can sleep at night. It's easy.
Black artists, educators, and historians around the country are facing increased pressure as federal funding cuts and executive actions target communities that are already marginalized and underfunded. Despite these challenges, Black cultural workers in Philly continue to persist in the work that they find meaningful and important. Block by Block reporter Tafari Robertson spoke with filmmaker Lunice Sarin about her experience as an independent cultural worker in Philadelphia.
Lunice Sarin is a Haitian-American filmmaker, educator, and cultural worker based in Philadelphia. She produces her own films, leads workshops, and recently installed a multimedia exhibition at Icebox Project Space featuring other local Haitian artists and excerpts from her documentary project called Miwa. According to Lunice, to be a cultural worker means a commitment to more than just creative production.
I think these days, the way that I'm thinking about my role as a cultural worker is one who shares, one who amplifies, and one who just creates spaces for community, spaces to celebrate ourselves and spaces to dream together and spaces to combat loneliness and to dream of a better world.
For Sarin and many others, making the choice to work in the cultural sector also means navigating a world dominated by part-time and gig-based projects. According to a 2024 study by the National Endowment of the Arts, 24% of cultural workers were employed part-time. 13% reported being self-employed.
It's something that I never wanted to do. I was always very afraid of the gig economy, you know, of like living one opportunity to another. But I think that what I'm realizing is like, A, fear can't be the reason you don't do the things that you want to do. And then B, like, there are so many of us who know how to do the things that we want to do that, like, if we start working together, there's no limit to what we can actually accomplish.
It's a community of workers that leans on each other for support, often by necessity. In recent years, many museums, universities, and other cultural organizations have responded to funding threats with budget cuts, which often means limiting resources or laying off staff. Lunice says that's something that she's experienced firsthand.
After the fourth institution that I left, feeling that same sense of depleted, you know, excited to work for my community in this way, and then entering into an institution that's asking me to not show up as my best self, or to compromise the way that I want to show up, or, you know, to offer this, but, you know, with an asterisk and not without the amount of preparation that I would have wanted, without the amount of structure that I would have wanted, thoughtfulness that I would have wanted.
Sarin works for herself instead of working full time at a major institution. She says that gives her more flexibility and control over her circumstances. But there are some downsides, like the lack of health insurance, paid leave, and other benefits.
That's what you lose when you choose to opt out of the institution. You lose health insurance and, like, the right to be a healthy person. But you do gain the autonomy of, like, making things the way that feels good, the way that feels organic, the way that feels true, a way that feels like it's about the community that you are being in community in a way that feels true to you.
Now, she runs a film production company named Tifi Productions and programs herbalist workshops and events through Red Room Apothecary. Both are projects she's founded and leads independently.
I'm really excited that I have figured out how to, like, man my own ship. And, you know, I'm just now filming my first documentary on my own. This is, like, the smallest crew I've ever had for a film. And I'm working on building an audience and doing events so that people can know my name and be aware of the kind of work that I do, so that when I do things, I can put it out directly to that audience.
For workers such as Sarin, the commitment to represent communities through their work is an opportunity to amplify crucial voices. Larger projects reflect a coming together of families, neighbors, and peers that share values and cultural backgrounds. However, this can also mean taking on more than just financial risks.
I'm very aware of ICE. You know, as a Haitian artist, as a person who specifically makes work with, for, and about the Haitian community, I'm very, there's always this looming, like, what if I'm doing this call for Haitians to come be in this space and then ICE comes and busts it down? That's something that is ever present in the foreground of my mind when I make a piece, and specifically for my community, is like, is this going to turn against us in a specific way, you know, in the most hellish, most nightmarish way possible? But again, I refuse to let my fear be what dictates what I do and don't do.
Lunice is taking her work into her own hands, and so are many other cultural workers. Disillusioned by organizations who answer to funders first and people second, they are carving out a new frontier of community labor that deserves to be recognized and protected. For Block by Block, this is Tafari Robertson.
The chicken may have crossed the road to get to the other side. But in one Northwest Philly neighborhood, toads cross the road for a very specific reason. And sometimes, they need a little help. Block by Block reporter Charlie Klein brings us this story.
This spring, if you're driving in Northwest Philly on a warm, rainy night, you may have to take a short detour. Not for potholes or construction work. For toads. For close to two decades, the Schuylkill Center for Environmental Education has been coordinating a toad detour. Volunteers help thousands of amphibians cross the road during their annual migration. Every year, toads travel to the Roxboro Reservoir to breed. Then they return to the forest. And a month or two later, thousands of tiny toadlets hop back across to join their parents in the forest. But toads aren't exactly cautious pedestrians. Before the detour began, hundreds were killed by cars each season. So in 2008, Lisa Levinson took matters into her own hands. She got a permit to close sections of Port Royal Road between 5 to 7 p.m., peak toad travel times. And the toad detour was born.
You can hear that trill?
Yeah.
That's the American toad.
18 years later, the toad detour is still going strong with the help of the Schuylkill Center. I stopped by to see it in action and to speak with volunteer and community outreach manager Susan Slewinski and other volunteers of all ages helping toads cross the road. While we spoke, excited young volunteers showed off their amphibious finds.
I've been doing this for a little over a year and a half, and this is my second toad detour season.
You got one! Wonderful! Oh, thank you! He's a cutie, isn't he? Oh, another one! Oh, that's a big lady, probably.
Volunteers fan out across the road in reflective vests, gently guiding toads to safety. They can shoo the toads across, or just pick them up and carry them. On the busiest nights, volunteers can use buckets to speed up travel times. It's kind of like toad septa. They keep careful records of each compact commuter they find. Some nights, it's 30 or 40 toads. Other nights, that number can climb to 200 to 300. All of that data feeds into something called the Toad Predictor, an online tool created by volunteer Chris Hand. It uses weather conditions to predict toad travels. Every day during spring, if the conditions are just right, the toad signal is sent out and the team assembles. While the life-saving detour is the main gig, Chris and the toads also have a side project. It started out with Chris photographing the toads interacting with trash on the street.
Cigarette packs, the little alcohol bottles, and the chewing tobacco stuff that people would throw out there. And I was like, oh, okay, well, the props are fun. Why not try some hats on these guys? A toad is actually a pretty easy thing to put a hat on. The females, when they're heading towards the reservoir, don't want any part of the hats. The males are usually just standing around looking for the females, so they're not so eager to move around. Although they're smaller, they're pretty easy to put a hat on.
And do you know how many toads you've put hats on?
Hundreds. I mean, it's been years and years, so I'm sure it's hundreds by now.
You can see these fashionable toads and the Toad Predictor on Chris's website, aptly named hatsfortoads.com. But Susan says the data collection is serious.
We have really good records of high rates of live toads encountered compared to deceased ones. So it kind of shows the impact closing these roads have in protecting the amphibians as they cross. It also really helps give folks an understanding of the diversity of the amphibian population around here. For example, last year we had really high numbers compared to years before of gray tree frogs. And that has helped inspire our education team to put up survey tubes for gray tree frogs so that can be incorporated into our educational programming now that we know that there's a good population here.
Volunteers mostly find American toads, but some species of frogs have joined the parade as well. Between crossings, Susan tells me what keeps volunteers coming back.
I really love that this is a family-friendly volunteer opportunity. When a kid encounters a toad and they're just like screaming for joy, no matter if it's the first toad of the night or the 100th toad of the night, that just joy and passion and just excitement for toads and frogs and just nature and wildlife as a whole, it really kind of reminds me of when I was a kid. And I'm sure, I at least hope that some of these crossings are formative memories or fond memories that these kids and families can look back on and really appreciate and hopefully inspire some folks to continue those conservation efforts and those that love of nature well into, you know, the rest of their lives.
Like Susan, some of the adult volunteers say they first developed a love for amphibians when they were children. That's certainly true for Chris.
My grandparents had a place in Canada on a big lake, and I was not allowed to go on the big lake, but I was allowed to go in the swamp because it was so shallow. So I spent a lot of my time looking at the bullfrogs there and stuff. So that's how I got into frogs. I just think they're cute little critters.
Toads aren't an endangered species, but Susan says maybe we have a responsibility to help them out.
These amphibians had these instincts to migrate back to their breeding grounds, to where they were born in the water, long before cars and roads were ever invented. We're the ones who put the roads here, we're the ones who drive the cars, and it's really up to people to make sure that we protect the animals as they're doing their thing. So it's up to humans to solve a human-made conservation issue.
And in terms of human responsibility, it's a pretty fun gig. For Block by Block, I'm Charlie Klein.
There you go, just grab them. There you go.
Block by Block is produced by Amadi Braxton, Abby Cruz, Anaya Davis, Ahmed Hassouna, Cheryl Jones, Charlie Klein, Corinne Martin, Milan Parker, Tafari Robertson, and us,
Sophia Mattia,
and Donya Ramadan. Cheryl Jones is our board operator tonight.
Brad Linder is Radio News Managing Editor for WPPM. Peta Liu is Radio Operations Manager. And Allison Durham is WPPM's Radio Program Manager.
We'll be back in 2 weeks with a new episode of Block by Block, featuring more stories about issues affecting life in the Philly region. And you can find past episodes of the show on PhillyCam's SoundCloud, Apple Podcasts, and wherever else you find your podcasts.
Thanks for listening.